Well, listen, I just want to say a really big thanks to this morning's panel. I think those were two sets of really excellent in-depth discussions with people who are really really immersed in these issues and really were able to give a level of texture and detail to these big challenges. Just remarkable. And I want to thank once again our panelists really for coming so far to spend today with us. Really, I can't thank you enough. It's been extremely helpful. And I do want to say, I omitted this morning to say thanks to Joel Barkin, who did a lot of arm twisting on this, I think, in calling in personal favors to get such a high quality panel put together. So thanks again. Let's move to this panel where we're talking about U.S. engagement on Kenya in the run-up to the referendum and now moving forward. And we're delighted to have with us today Michelle Gavin, who's a special assistant to the president and senior director for African Affairs at the NSC, National Security Council. Michelle is a long-time Africanist, was engaged with probably one of our most active senators, Senator Feingold, who active on Africa on the Hill for many years, very keen interest in Kenya as well. U.S. engagement, I think, in this last period has been proactive, energetic, and I think really reflects U.S. interests in Kenya, which are in some ways more mature and probably more broad than they are in much of Africa, I think. I think it also reflects the personal interests of President Barack Obama. Partly it has to do with his family tree, but I think equally probably by a sense of optimism about Kenya, optimism and expectation. I think you really can't spend time in Kenya without being struck by the incredible political energy, the wealth of thoughtful, forward-thinking intellectuals and analysts. We've had a great sampling of that here today. Who have been really voices over decades now for political reform, political openness, kind of countervailing voices within Kenyan society. So we heard this morning, I think, a lot about the challenges ahead. And while there are a lot of celebration around the referendum, which is, you know, well-warranted celebration, given that just 2 years ago, Kenya was going through such a deep and vituperative crisis. But a lot of challenges ahead. And while the referendum, there are certain lessons we can draw from that, the stakes will be much higher, the issues much more complex in the coming national election. And then again, the Constitution addressed, which was intended to address some very specific political problems within Kenya, that will face challenges logistic and political of its own, with strong vested interests still at play, and so forth. So I'm going to turn to Michelle first to talk about U.S. engagement at this time. Michelle has been at the center of really mobilizing this pretty remarkable U.S. commitment to seeing this constitution through, to keeping Kenya really high on the radar screen despite major crises going on in Somalia next door, in Sudan, and then in the global world. To have President Obama, Vice President Biden, Secretary Clinton so very engaged on Kenya during this time is pretty remarkable. And I think seeing the energy that went behind this constitution, you couldn't help being a bit enthusiastic about it. And I think one of the questions for U.S. policy is, in some ways, were we perhaps too enthusiastic in our support and endorsement for this constitution? I think there's some, you know, it's a fine line, I think, between supporting a process versus kind of the perception, at least, that we were coming down one way or the other in terms of the outcome. But I'm sure Michelle has heard that question before and hope we can address that. So, Michelle, I'm going to turn to you for thoughts on the process so far and U.S. engagement moving forward. Then we'll turn briefly to our panelists for very quick remarks and then open up the floor for discussion. Thanks.
And it's a pleasure to be joining you all today. I'm sorry that I didn't have the benefit of hearing from the panel earlier, because I've heard nothing but great things about it, and it sounds like it's been a very insightful session thus far. So with that sort of disadvantage and injecting myself into an ongoing conversation, I'll be quite brief, because what's interesting is always the give and take. But in terms of how this administration has looked at Kenya since taking office, and when the Obama administration took office, we were keenly aware of the stakes in Kenya, the memories of early 2008 is still very, very vivid for the administration, and a sense of urgency around not allowing the situation to deteriorate in the way that we saw before, and a real fear that another round of violence like that would be that much more difficult for Kenya to pull itself back from the brink. So there was a sense of urgency and worry about return to crisis. But I would say that there was also a very keen sense of potential. You know, having seen what Kenyans themselves were able to do to pull the country back from the brink, the mobilization and coordination and cohesion that we saw in civil society and parts of the Kenyan private sector, and the kind of leadership there, combined with some interesting indicators of generational change in the Kenyan political system, also, I think for a lot of us, gave a sense of there's opportunity here. There's some important and interesting Kenyan partners to work with moving forward. And so with that kind of immediate sense of where the dynamics were in Kenya, and then, of course, the set of reasons that every U.S. administration has had to care about Kenya, the fact that it's been historically one of our strongest partners on the continent and on a wealth of critical issues of surrounding regional security, humanitarian access for the region writ large. Kenya has been an absolutely essential partner, and certainly the depth of our relationship with Kenya is almost unique on the continent. The scope of ties, the sheer number of Kenyan students who study in the U.S., the robust Peace Corps program, this is a longstanding relationship that we value for multiple reasons. And so when we kind of looked at sub-Saharan Africa at the very beginning, you had your very obvious hotspots and crisis points, Sudan, Somalia, certainly, and others, but you also had these two regionally essential states on either side of the continent, Nigeria and Kenya, where you'd had seen recently some alarming trajectories, and where we believed we needed to focus a great deal of attention right from the start. We also had some interesting assets to bring to bear in trying to ensure that we were giving it all we've got to strengthen the U.S.-Kenyan relationship and, in fact, create conditions conducive to greater Kenyan stability. And the most obvious asset being, of course, the President of the United States, whose knowledge of Kenya is quite considerable and extensive, whose interest is keen. I can assure you that the questions I got from day one on Kenya coming from the West Wing were tough questions and obviously extraordinarily well-informed. And he does have a unique degree of influence, perhaps, or soft power on the continent writ large, and certainly, I think, in Kenya. So that's a tremendous asset. But I would also note there's a great asset in having an Assistant Secretary of State in Johnny Carson, who's a former U.S. ambassador to Kenya and who was there during a critical time, certainly in Kenya's political development. So in addition to caring deeply about Kenya, loving it, loving its people, believing in its potential, he also had relationships with an awful lot of key players that certainly I think helped facilitate our diplomatic engagement, obviously working with Ambassador Ranenberger and the team on the ground. So all of this sort of backdrop is to say that we came in thinking, okay, we cannot be sort of asleep at the switch on Kenya just because the immediate crisis has passed. We actually should be surging forward in trying to engage and particularly to promote the reform agenda that was, that fourth basket of issues identified by Kofi Annan and his team in trying to facilitate it into the crisis. And so trying to find ways to push forward on reform quite robustly was kind of the mantra from the start. And we did make a big push. There were some early visits, some early strong public messages, where the message that we were sending to Kenyan leadership was, look, there's no business as usual with those who might be working to obstruct the reform agenda. The stakes are far too high. We all saw the nature of those stakes during the crisis. And so some very strong signals at the leadership level. But in parallel to that was an effort to reach out and strengthen and support those positive factors that we saw, those sources of tremendous potential. So some very robust democracy and governance programming to the tune of over $60 million, which in the context of sub-Saharan Africa, Kenya does extremely well. And then also a series of visits over the course of the first year and a half of this administration. We had Secretary Clinton's engagement last summer, the summer of 2009, and a key element of that was not just the standard kind of bilateral meetings with Kenyan leadership, but the town hall event that she did at the University of Nairobi, reaching out, intended to be speaking directly with, engaging with, and getting ideas from Kenyan civil society, and crucially younger Kenyans. And then Vice President Biden traveling this past summer doing a similar event where his messages were very directly aimed at Kenyan citizens, not necessarily specific to Kenyan political leaders. We also had, deployed the president's voice in different ways. Certainly he's engaged with his counterparts in the Kenyan government. But he is also, for example, did an exclusive interview with Kenyan Broadcasting back in June in an effort to try and reach, again, directly to the Kenyan people. And so it's true that we have come in for some criticism, a sense that our voices have been perhaps too loud in supporting the reform agenda. But I think that a close look at where we've been over the course of the last 18 months has made it clear that what our strategy and our effort has never been about trying to promote the reform agenda simply because we believe it's the right thing to do. It's been much more focused on trying to be supportive of Kenyan civil society and those pull factors from within Kenya that are kind of pulling leadership along in advancing that agenda and moving forward. And this is it's pretty clear in all the public statements, and it's very clearly been part of our approach. Certainly the $45 million Yes Youth Can initiative that was launched last, I think, December is a tremendously important part of that, with this idea that the more that you empower young Kenyans to engage civically, to be a part of the system, and to be able to articulate clearly where it is they want their country to go, the more you're going to see Kenya driving toward a place where it's going to be sustainably stable and have better chances for even more prosperity and growth in the years ahead. And the last thing I would just say is that while I do feel very good that we've given it a lot, we've given it a lot of effort to try and encourage the reform agenda in Kenya, we are and we were thrilled to see a largely peaceful referendum, and very thrilled to see that the aftermath remained peaceful. We're not under any impression that kind of this work is done and sort of, okay, we can check Kenya off the list of things that we need to do. Far, far from it. It's very clear, and this high-level engagement has helped make it very clear to senior officials in the U.S. government that there's a tremendous amount of work to be done. I think for the vice president, when he was engaging with the Reform Caucus of Parliamentarians this past summer in Nairobi, for him to hear from them kind of just how ambitious it would be to be moving out on implementing legislation for a new constitution, I think helped give us a real flavor of how much work there is to be done and how important it'll be not to sort of let the sense of exhaustion and relief that I would imagine Kenyan civil society leaders must have felt in the wake of a peaceful referendum, not to let that kind of take hold and let momentum sort of dissipate and find ourselves less engaged, or certainly Kenyan civil society less prepared for the very, very difficult days to come. So when I think of all the kind of overused policymaker metaphors that are bandied about constantly, the sort of shorthand in my mind to think about this is that it's not that we believe, you know, Kenya's turned a corner here. It's more about sort of a door that didn't close, right? They didn't close the door to be able to move forward and really realize the tremendous potential of a truly amazing country. But there's a lot of work yet to be done. And so I want to make sure that other people have a chance to speak and there's a chance for some exchange.
Great. Thank you so much, Michelle. We're going to turn to our respondents on the panel. I won't go into introducing you again since you've already spoken at some point today. But first, David and Dee, who I think will talk a little bit about the political engagement and perhaps some of the technical issues going forward in that complicated process of devolution, but we'll see what he has to say. We have Kennedy Masime from ELOG, who will talk, I think, about U.S. engagement in civil society, and particularly perhaps with a view to the forthcoming elections. And then Joel Barkin, a senior associate here at CSIS, I think is going to talk a little bit about democracy promotion and how it's evolved over time in Kenya, how Kenya has changed, how our approach needs to change, mm-hmm. and what that might say about democracy promotion, or whatever you want to call it, in Africa more broadly. So, David, let's turn to you, and I've asked our panelists to keep it very brief. It is so cold up here that we all want to get down anyway. Next time we'll have blankets up here.
David.
Unfortunately, I mean, this is a subject which I must confess I'm not really as comfortable on, as at least have a stronger vantage point as perhaps what I was speaking about earlier. So I think my comments are going to be very much in a manner of really a observer perspective. I think just reflecting on a couple of things. One is that I think one of the things I think about, I mean, now looking back now into the benefit of hindsight, is that if you look at the historical engagement of countries like the U.S. with African countries, and in particular in developing countries in general, is historical was very much around economic and security, economic development and security, and very state-centric, of course. And engagement on democracy and governance is very recent, only going back to the early 90s, certainly in our case. And one cannot help and wonder whether things might have been different if, in fact, development and democracy and governance had been at the center of the engagement from the beginning. I think it's not really the fact that, you know, It reflects also the sort of order of things at the time that I think our countries also made the mistake of focusing on economic development at the expense of political development. And it's proving quite clearly that, you know, you can't really, in Africa certainly, we could really have gone the Asian route, that political development is perhaps much more fundamental as a precursor to economic development. Having said that, I think the U.S. has acquitted itself very well in terms of engaging on democracy and governance and engaging civil society. Very strong support, very strategic interventions throughout the 90s. I think their programs, I think Joel and I can have sort of been involved with the Parliamentary Strengthening Program, which is financed by USAID and executed by SUNY. I'm particularly proud of that because it actually took over something which I had started in the early 90s, the Institute of Economic Affairs, and it sort of just scaled it up. The NDI support, which was being talked about here a bit earlier, and so that how that's, Gerard can talk about that and various other things. Besides that kind of programmatic support, I think the other thing which has been very important is bold and sometimes decisive action, very risky, but bold sort of decisive diplomatic action. Example which comes to mind immediately was the decision to sort of deny and publicize denying visas to certain high-ranking officials recently who were seen to be, and it was stated for obstructing reform. We saw shortly thereafter the pipeline of corruption prosecutions, which had sort of stalled, open up very quickly. And you saw a lot of cases going to court. And I'm told by people in that field that that had to do with the Attorney General having been on that list of people. And it did. And I think that particular action, I believe, has acted as a deterrent to some of the people who would have been more obstructive of the constitutional reform making process. It took the wind out of a lot of people's sails. So those sort of actions, they are risky. I think they have to be taken, I think, on the balance that it's actually been quite strong. So the question of, again, you know, supporting the process versus endorsing the product is I think one which required walking a very fine line. I think on the whole, I think except for people who wanted to politicize it, it was not such a big issue. I think the messaging of what the U.S. was supporting was quite clear, but of course, you know, the problem with political propaganda, I mean, here, there, everywhere, it's very difficult to actually distinguish, counteract people who deliberately distort things very skillfully. One thing I want to point out going forward in terms of in terms of risks and issues to watch about. I think if you look at the way they support, quite frankly, for on democracy governance and particularly civil society, has evolved initially, and the U.S. as well as a lot of other development partners, in a sense, a lot of the support that went to civil society was in fact more of an accident. It was a consequence of the deteriorating relationships with the government. So they had programmed money. The government was not cooperating as a partner, and a lot of this support ended up in civil society. It was not really programmed for civil society. It was the fact that it was an alternative to working with government. Because historically, a lot of the institutions work with government. And what we saw in 2003, when there was a big euphoria that you had a new government, reformist government, you saw a shift of focus again back to government. There was a shift also, not just of focus, but also of resources. And a lot of the, and civil society, that was one of the things that really took the wind out of civil society sales. It did also contribute to the, even as the environment deteriorated, the support very much, the people like the U.S. and they were not able to sort of shift back the focus, so that when it came to election, you still, in fact, just to give an illustration, I think even the debate of whether to monitor the 2007 election, there were people who had felt that there was no need for international monitors. Monitoring of the 2000 election said, oh, Kenya has really had good track record of elections. This is not whatever. Let's just focus on working with government, on development, on healthcare, and all those things. So I think that's something I think which is important to guard against, that there is still that kind of euphoria, yes, that maybe, again, I think the lesson from that is that really the real The real challenge at this point in time, I think, more than any other time, is in terms of implementation, is that it's deepening. It's actually deepening civil society. And I think this is the time now to begin to think very fundamentally about sustainability of civil society. It's, as I was saying, it's been the kind of support you've seen has been very episodic, and it's actually a lot of time you see it's been driven by sort of. It depends very much on how government is behaving. When government is behaving well, you find that the development partners. So I think one needs to maintain that two-track process. Yes, engaging government and doing, but also looking at how to sustain and sustain. Maybe sort of looking at questions of deepening and strengthening and sustaining civil society, particularly to build the capability to drive. The implementation process, and also to institutionalize just civic sort of vigilance and participation, citizen participation in the governance of the country. So it's a tall order, but I think in for a penny. in for the sort of for the whole hall. Let me stop.
Great. Thank you, David. Let's turn to Kennedy, who I think will also speak a bit to civil society.
Thank you very much. Perhaps I should begin by narrating a story about two events I attended in Nairobi in the past 2 or 3 years. I think the first one was the elections and the announcement of the American elections. And the funny thing about them is that you are invited to report at 5 in the morning. It's not always that you attend meetings at 5. So we went there, and at the American Embassy, there were a lot of us, from top government ministers to civil society, everybody. They know really how to mobilize the Kenyan society. I think they have a good list. We were there, you could touch the emotions. People were, crammed around the screens, with their eyes misting. Most of them were crying, and it was a big event. The next one was two years later, and I believe Richard is not going to like this. It was now the British election and the subsequent announcement. So we were there. We also reported at 5. there was no connection. Actually, we concentrated more on the tea and the drinks than the actual election. Actually, people were turning their back to the screen, and it was going. It was like there was no connection. This just to illustrate the Kenyans' fascinations and expectations of the United States. In Africa, in the extended setup, you can report your father to the older brother. And you can do it directly, and they are supposed to intervene on your behalf. Increasingly, it's not the older brother, but the more successful brother. Now the power dynamics have changed, not age anymore, but success, which goes with either education or wealth. I've attended the briefing session with the American ambassador. And it's more or less the same setup. When we go there as civil society, we are reporting to the uncle with a lot of expectations on the father could be the government and how they are treating us and everything. The center where I work, we have been recipients of USAID funds since I joined, which was around 2001. I've seen the evolution of the nature of funding. Initially, we used to get the money directly through the Democracy and Governance Program. At some point, I think there's a bit on outsourcing now, where we access the money through SUNY, or PAC Kenya's Kenya Civil Society Strengthening Program. Like David has said, sometimes the amounts change. Initially, it was good. The amounts were okay. Then it has dipped. They are in smaller portions. And also, like he said, following the 2003 elections, there was that shift to government. We had this government programs, the governance and justice, governance, justice and law program, where a lot of money went. And it was like civil society has done its work and has outlived its usefulness. We had also some other bigger programs like the public financial reform, you know, strategy, where a lot of money was put on the government, and it was hoped that the government will behave and things will be okay. So I just want to reiterate what David Ndia said, that there's the demand side of things and there's the supply side of things. There's always need to keep a balance. If you over-support the other side, like the supply side of things, things don't work. Most of those programs eventually stall, and they don't yield the results, intended results. So I think there's good way. There's need to balance that thing. Kenya has been reforming gradually. People always say it's been evolutionary. I think this is the first time that there's a bit of a revolution, though it is a revolution during peacetime, like some people say. There's a lot that needs to be undertaken in terms of governance reforms. Perhaps we just go through the list that I gave in the morning in terms of the work that civil society needs to do. There's civic and voter education. The constitution is very big. There are a lot of things that citizens need to get to know. There's facilitating public participation. I can even talk of publics. You can talk of, educating people on how to act as members of political parties. You can educate county people on how to interact with their new structures. You can educate women on how to take advantage of, some of those affirmative action seats or the advantages that they have received through the constitution, etc. So it's a lot of work. You can support legislative and institutional and administrative reforms. And when we talk of legislative, at least the center I work for, we worked on a number of laws back in the 90s, early 2000s. We supported through a private member the law that created the Parliamentary Service Commission, and also the law that the Political Parties Act. The Political Parties Act, for instance, took us about 8 years, with a lot of work, a lot of research, a lot of pushing. The law is, as it is now, is not even perfect. It takes a lot of time, a lot of resources, and a lot of energy to push for a law and get it right. By the time there is an equilibrium between the law and reality, it's a lot of work. Here is a situation where we are supposed to do, people talk of 49 because of the listing. Is it the sixth or fifth schedule? The 49th item is actually any other law that is contrary to the constitution. So the listing is not 49. There could be less because some of them can be done once. But if you look at the body of the constitution, it also anticipates a number of laws. When the constitution says that there will be freedom of information, it requires a law to give it effect. So it's a lot of work that needs to go into operationalizing that constitution, and civil society will need support. There are aspects of conflict resolution, technical assistance, capacity building. All this requires to be done by civil society, and it will take a lot of resources. We appreciate the assistance that the U.S. through USAID and these other agencies have been giving civil society. The only thing is that, it's good, but how is it, what is structured? There's a difference between funding development. And by development, actually the development civil society, where you go build schools, sink boards. It's very direct, and you can program it and say we'll sink boards I mean, 20 bowls in 2 years, and you can determine what time it takes to do a bowl and how to do it. But governance, political, and legislative reforms are different ballgame altogether. It's, in my experience, not amenable to project, you know, funding or arrangements where you say, and you have to write it up front, that we'll be doing ABCD for 3 years. It will cost this money. It doesn't work like that in reality. So in terms of project funding, and especially in the context of the new constitution, I think we should think, deeply about how we structure funding so that it's relevant, and it does not actually undermine the work that it's intended to do. So what I can say is that funding is good. We can feel the weight of the American, funding, especially now, following the promulgation of the new constitution. Our only worry is that it should be structured properly so that you can achieve impact. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's turn to Joel. And if David and Kennedy, or David, you could turn off your mic.
I'll try to be relatively succinct, but I want to do so in the context of the whole enterprise of democratization and democracy promotion generally. The United States has been involved in democracy promotion since the mid-1980s, beginning in Latin America. In Africa, it's essentially an exercise that began in the early 90s, and Kenya has been a focus of it, more or less on a sustained basis, therefore, for almost 18 years. What have we learned? Because while the referendum and the run-up to it and its successful conclusion certainly makes us all feel very warm inside, and rightfully so, nonetheless, our interventions on behalf of the democratization process in Kenya have not always been so sophisticated and sustained, and there are some broader takeaways to pay attention to. The first of all is that it's a long process. It's taken 20 years. It's two steps forward, and in some cases, particularly in the early stages of the struggle, arguably 1 3/4 steps back. It's tortuous, and it's a struggle. And let's make no bones about it. It's a political struggle between those who want to retain power and those who want to come into power, to some extent, for their own interests, but also a reform coalition, which is not always composed only of reformers. There are strange bedfellows, let's put it this way, along the way. And it leads to very mixed results. The United States entered this in the early 90s very forcefully to drive the first multi-party election in Kenya. And the first lesson, quite obviously, was that the employment of conditionality and the assistance to civil society does not necessarily lead to an alternation of government. That occurred in 2002, when then as now, there were tremendously high expectations that the corner had been turned, and I think it was Michelle, you said the door was really opened as opposed to the corner had been turned. And we also shifted gears at that point in time from simply assistance for free and fair elections to the building of institutions of countervailing power. And here's where I think the long-term effort really needs to focus on. It's below the radar screen. It often gets trumped by security interests. We have hung in there very well in Kenya. The SUNY program on the legislature has been mentioned as, I think, in many ways, an amazing case study of what can be accomplished if funding matched with a very high level of expertise that the U.S. deploys in the field is maintained for a sustained period of time. It's now 12 years. It began in 1998. It's going to continue to 2014. But that kind of a cycle of a project will have crossed three administrations and multiple ambassadors. And the biggest risk, in my mind, is that the institutional memory gets frayed along the way, and when you have a turnover in personnel, When the baton is passed, it's not always passed as well as it should be. So where do I come down on this, and where do we go from here? To some extent, to continue what we've been doing because it has worked, but to keep in mind that quite obviously the realities, as we've heard today, are different than they were even before the referendum, and that there's going to be a change in administration in Kenya in 2012. And as David and Dee, I thought, laid out very well, the structure of politics has changed fundamentally. So simply doing more of the same is not necessarily the answer. And we can't go to sleep at the switch, because if I'm allowed a personal comment, I was an observer to the 2007 election, and I felt we had gone asleep at the switch. And we committed the mistake that Ken Nyaunde mentioned this morning. We focused on personalities on the Electoral Commission and not institution. So we have to keep our eye on the institutional ball, even though it isn't very sexy. That in turn means that the whole USAID embassy relationship, and former Ambassador Bellamy is here at the back of the room, he knows this well, this has to be a very comfortable relationship, and this in turn means that in terms of who we send out to the field, particularly at the USAID level, where my concerns are greatest, that they really match and are people who can work with the embassy, and that we have people who really want to invest in learning what has come before in order to move forward. Focus on the institutional ball, that means the legislative program, although that's beginning to phase out, and rightly so, because the issue of sustainability has to be addressed. Do we simply do more of the same because it's worked, or at one point, when do you go home or shift gears? What about civil society? The last year I've been conducting a study for the National Endowment for Democracy on recipients of democracy assistance. And the telling figure is globally what Kennedy has reported this morning, and that is overwhelmingly civil society is dependent on external funding. Maybe it's time we start re-examining this, demanding matching grants, even though it might be small, say at 10%, because to the extent that which the donors in the U.S. in particular can support democratization efforts, they must have viable partners. And one demonstration of viable partners are those groups that can raise at least some measure of their own resources as to those who are just, in effect, begging. I'd like to see a continuation of the immediate past efforts in 2012, the PVT vote, the mapping. You and I have talked about this before. I mean, it's why did it take so long for us to do this? Why not an early election? So I guess I would stop there. We can congratulate ourselves, but we should be careful in letting it go at that. I believe that we can still do better, and that's going to require some continuing commitment, both in Nairobi and here.
Great. Thanks very much to the panel. Well, let's open up for questions and comments from the floor. I wonder if any of our Kenyan participants from this morning might like to might add anything. Feroz on the judiciary, the police, which is a particular interest of ours. Feroz Darwaj is up front here. The mic is coming.
Thank you. Without in any way reducing the support to the civil society and the focus that you have, some attention to the need to look at political parties, strengthening them. We have to pay attention to how does how do political parties recruit their lower leadership, second, third tier leadership, etc. And what we are seeing is a perpetuation of the mentors are these the people you have rejected as a focus of interaction. That's why the large focus on civil society. But if you leave them alone, they'll recruit people who look like them.
Thank you. Should we take a couple more?
Yes.
We're talking of sustainability from the point of view of work in Kenya. But we need sustainability from the U.S. side. When Smith Hempston was there, what the U.S. position did was to give legitimacy to reform. The ambassador who followed him disengaged, leaving Moy an open field. These hard in and out.
Thank you, Feroz. Questions, comments? This is your chance to. John.
I'm planning a second bite of the apple, but I can remember a very stark time in Kenya, when I was in Kenya following Joel, when the concerns about democracy and concerns about security came in direct conflict with each other. And those have not diminished. And I'm a democracy person, I'm not a security person, but I'm interested in how the U.S. is balancing their concern for security and thinking about the Somali threat and all of that with this ongoing concern for democracy. It's a classic struggle.
Which took, I think, something of a hit in the post 9/11 phase where we may be moving away from that, but it is a balance that always has to be struck. More questions here. Yes.
David Brown, I'm a master's student at SAIS. A question about the decision last year to revoke travel visas from government officials. I was wondering, Michelle, maybe you could talk about the decision to use that strategy and for any of you, the sustainability of that tool going forward. It seems like you think it was successful, but do we run too great a risk of pushing partners away?
And again, it gets a little bit to the question of this individuals versus institutions and these folks, what was the process by which it was determined these particular folks? I don't know if you're able to answer that, but I think... versus others, because there's plenty to choose from, and what was the process that singled it out? Was it an American process or was it a Kenyan process? And I think we run that too now with the ICC and questions around that. Perhaps you want to mention something around that as well. So let's turn back to the. Oh, we got one more over here. We'll take them all, and we'll.
It's a comment on individual travel bans that I want to make in the light of the comment that has been made. As a Kenyan who was in Kenya that particular time the bans were announced, I really think that was a very legitimate intervention. Very legitimate intervention. But it had its own weaknesses. The focus was on individuals without focusing also on their families. Right? In the sense that you did not complete the cycle, and for it to have good impact, we really insist, and this is the message we have been really speaking hard about, you must have a focus on their own families, spouses, and children who are in U.S. standing here. That's the only way of weakening their sense of impunity. That's the way of undermining their efforts to frustrate reforms at home. And only when you do that, that's when they become sensitive to the things that they do at home. Going back to the question of continuity that Firoz has talked about, I think there is need to emphasize the significance of having, for lack of a better word, of having ambassadors who fully understand Kenya and who are very committed to embedding the discourse of reforms at every level. He's talked about disengagements at some particular time and others, but we need that consistency. We need that consistency for one reason, that governments are very sensitive to how you engage. And if you come with silence diplomacy and dining diplomacy, that's not the language people who prefer impunity understand best. So if there is going to be any transition and change in Kenya, let that one be a transition that will lead to getting someone who fully understands Kenya, someone who is going to play a critical role in trying to ensure that reforms are fully implemented. We are moving towards a very difficult phase of implementing the constitution. This is the most hard part of the reform building agenda in Kenya now. And the frustrations will come at different levels. And getting someone who understands it and making sure that the government understands that it's under watch and various individuals are under watch is very critical. But my final point is, I think this idea of saying let's disconnect individuals from institutions is an issue that we need to pay much more attention very seriously, because there is no significant difference between the agency and the structure under some circumstances. And therefore getting to know that the actors could be as bad as, can make institutions bad is also important. So let's try to see how we can balance the two.
I have a very quick question regarding the inability of civil society to gather funds domestically independent of foreign funders. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about the reasons behind that inability or lack of desire to gather funds on their own, and the types of support and or sanctions or force that you would use on civil society to make them gather funds on their own.
Thank you. From stick to carrot, very briefly, to emphasize the importance of assistance to the electoral process. Kenya faces two massive challenges simultaneously, and they are, of course, related. Implementation of the constitution on the one hand, and preparing, hopefully, for a successful election as early as August 2012 on the other. And these have to happen simultaneously, and the sequencing of that is going to be very challenging as well. One of the things that came out of the Krieger report was the importance of sustaining all assistance to the electoral process through the election cycle. And I'm not just talking about support for Elog and Kennedy, but support for the Election Commission and others. How important that is, because historically Kenya has suffered from feast and famine.
Because we can use this time to respond and kind of wrap up as well. Why don't we start with you, and we'll come back to you at the end for any final thoughts.
Okay. Well, thank you. That was a good mix of good questions and good advice, which I'm happy to take on board, and some excellent points. I guess just trying to work through some of these issues, I certainly take the point on the importance of political parties, and for Kenya to kind of realize this potential that everyone talks about, one has to see a change in the nature of political parties in Kenya. They're sort of ever, right now they're kind of these amorphous, ever-shifting entities that have, unfortunately, historically and still, I think it's fair to say, more to do with sort of identity politics than with political platforms. I hear what you're saying. I do think that particularly engaging with young people is a big part of getting at that issue. And that's not something that's going to change immediately. You have to kind of create a different politics to have political party structures that reflect it. And creating a different politics is a Kenyan enterprise. It's not a U.S. enterprise for Kenyans, but we certainly can try and be supportive in ways that are effective and not naive about the nature of political party structure. So I think it's a great point. Also on kind of the waxing and waning of U.S. policy and attention to some of these issues and the importance of getting the right people on the ground. And Joel spoke to the importance of the AID mission director, obviously the importance of having strong ambassadors. Like Ambassador Bellamy, it's just great to see you. The U.S. political system is what it is. And so if there are changing administration priorities from one to another, then it's the job of an ambassador to reflect the priorities of the president and the administration. So there are always going to be some constraints on our consistency writ large. But I do think that there isn't a whole lot of disagreement about Kenya's importance. I don't think anyone there's nothing partisan about saying that Kenya is a tremendously important partner to the U.S. And I do think there's a widespread consensus on how critical reform is in the Kenyan political system to Kenya's stability. So I'm hopeful that moving forward, beyond the days of the administration that I work for and out, into the kind of out years that we would have that. But I just would point out there are always constraints. I certainly think it's not going to change anytime soon that this is seen as an incredibly important and sensitive post, and one where we need to be putting excellent personnel and ensuring that they work together effectively. Tensions between democracy and security and how to reconcile them. Well, that's sort of the subject, I think, for if not another panel, another kind of week-long symposium. But it's yes, I do think these tensions sometimes manifest themselves in Kenya just as they do here. I also think that it's very clear to us within the administration that we're not our investment in having a strong partner on security issues in Kenya is utterly lost if the country finds itself in conflict. And these are the kinds of very, very stark potentialities that people were focused on during that post-election violence. So in some ways, that lesson has helped guide our thinking that we need to be focused on the long term here. You have a much stronger partner in addressing critical security issues if you have a one that's not kind of shaky at its very foundations. And so I fundamentally and in the long term, I don't think these things are in tension in any way. I think they're very much complementary. In terms of specific issues where sometimes you might have a security imperative that domestically we might have a security imperative that might lead us down one track and a set of concerns around civil liberties that might be in tension with that. I think that happens in other societies as well, and it's our job to keep our eye on the ball, understand that these are ultimately decisions that will be managed by Kenyans, but to keep that focus on the importance of having a strong and resilient partner, and that means making sure that we get the governance piece right. On visa bans and targeted sorts of sanctions, I'm not going to kind of speak to the kind of information that necessarily informed some of the specific decisions because it's not appropriate here. But what I would say is that it was very important, I think, from the get-go to make plain that this message we were sending, no business as usual, was not purely a rhetorical message. There was a sense that there was perhaps too much comfort in some circles that crisis had passed and we can all sort of go back to the same kinds of relationships that one had seen before. And so I think that that was an important part of sending that signal. But what I would say about that kind of tool and deploying that kind of tool in a case like Kenya is that in isolation, I think it would have been utterly ineffective, right? If basically your policy focuses on what you have to complain about and you're not doing much on the side of what are you trying to build, I think the sort of net result of that is making ourselves perhaps feel good and not a whole a heck of a lot more. I think that, you know, as a part of an approach that is much more encompassing and thought out and carefully sequenced, where you're trying to send one signal here while you're providing some support for the change agents elsewhere, then I think it can be quite effective. And certainly it's interesting because I've heard complaints about this absolutely across the spectrum, this incredibly heavy-handed and inappropriate and setback efforts, that it wasn't strong enough and didn't actually bite because you should have gone much further. And so I listened to it all. It's helpful guidance, and I think the most important thing to say about that is I think that tools like that can be very effective, but very rarely are they effective in a vacuum. On accountability, this is an incredibly important piece, one that all senior USG officials have spoken to and they've spoken publicly about Kenya. And I think that it's very hard to see how Kenya kind of definitively enters a new era in its politics if you don't have any kind of accountability whatsoever for orchestrating the sort of violence that we saw in the post-election period. It's just not it's not a viable way to proceed. And so, again, these are, we can't want this more than the Kenyan people. It's a Kenyan issue, but our position has been crystal clear from the beginning, and it's not going to change. I'm going to let somebody else speak to civil society's efforts to get more support and financial support domestically. But on the importance of assistance to the electoral process, it's an excellent point, and it would be absolutely tragic, actually, if we'd moved out as aggressively we have on trying to help see that trajectory in Kenya tick upward on the governance side and drop the ball on the electoral process. So I take it on board, and I have a set of questions I want to go back and ask my colleagues and make sure that we're in the right place.
Thank you. Have quick wrap-up remarks from the remainder of our panel.
Okay, quickly, I will speak to some civil society issues, and I think just perspective. I'm sure my colleagues will also give some perspectives to reinforce that. I think on the question of supporting civil society, I think a satisfactory model is, what's a satisfactory model? I think that's a difficult question. I've just given my own perspectives that really what my colleague was saying about a project approach is really, well, you can see that's absolutely the wrong way to look at supporting civil society. For two reasons. I think I'll highlight two reasons. One is that, first of all, I mean, in a democratic process, civil society is an end in itself. Its existence is one of the objectives. So if you look at a project, and I think that's what's been happening, because of the perspective of looking at it as a project, so you say, you know, and the people in the development, especially having people from a development, economic development doing this, is, you know, you do an economic development project and it's finished, and you move on. And you don't see as at the purpose of civil society is actually an existential thing that you're trying to ensure that it's always there. You say in democracy, vigilance must be eternal. So that's one of the perspectives. They look at the fact that it's really seeing the existence and of an active, robust, sort of vibrant civil society is one of the ends, not something that you want to remind them and say, oh, we've had a good referendum, so, you know, you don't need civil society for now until, you know, next time. The second one, which I think is a very oft missed dimension, for me is very important because I've witnessed it happening a lot, is that civil society in societies like ours has another sort of spin-off, which is leadership development. really, if you look at civil society, really is the incubation of an alternative leadership. Because remember, the situation you're coming from is one where the leadership culture that you have in the public realm is not what you want. So people who are being socialized in that system are not the ones you want to be the leaders or the new whatever. So where are the sort of alternative leadership for the new sort of dispensation going to come from? The other people who are sort of socialized in civil society. And I mean, countless personal examples. I mean, my last PA, my research assistant, my last personal research assistant is now the director of governance in the government. And she sort of, 5-6 years ago, she was just my research assistant. And she's a director of governance and treasury. And there are many countless individuals you can see who are coming out into government, bringing that different sort of culture. And that, again, is an output which is often missed, that the supporting civil society is contributing. Because there is no other platform, there's no other forum where people can acquire the sort of kind of values and whatever that you want for in an open society and democratic governance.
David, I think we're going to...
Yeah, just one final point on domestic funding. Okay. Why the issue of domestic funding, why is there not domestic... what's the problem with domestic funding? There is actually a domestically funded finance civil society, especially interest groups. You know, if you look at the NCCK, the church type organization, interest groups are predominantly domestically financed. The foreign dependent civil society is what I call the intellectual civil society, especially the think tanks, the governance NGOs, and those type of institutions. And why is that? It's basically because you don't have the private wealth in countries like Kenya, which supports those kind of institutions in a country like this. You don't have George Soros and people like that. So I think it's inevitable that for a long time that's going to have to be externally or funded from other sources until you sort of develop the sort of the private wealth that can sort of philanthropy that can support that sector.
Thanks. Just quickly to Kennedy and then Joel. So much for
okay, thank you very much on the ability of civil society to gather resources locally. I mean, what are the possible sources? One could be the population. I've been to the UK where and attended two buses where a student, is it buses? I know English is not my language. Where student, you know, they say you get in with £3, £2, and they get the money for people like ActionAid and Oxford. Unfortunately, this cannot happen in Kenya because of decades of, you know, patronage. Nowadays, we are coming from a country where, you know, people demand, is it sitting and now standing allowance for attending a rally? The dependency in our country is so much. But it was not like that before. Those who have read our history know what used to happen. Pioneer civil societies like the Kikuyu Central Association used to get monies of their own and take people like Kenyatta, you know, just villagers selling chicken and small monies and pulling it together and sending a delegation to London or taking football for further education. That initiative has been abused by patronage, where now elites used to come. In the 80s, when it was bad, you used to have people, I mean, you have organized a fundraiser, and one individual come and will give the entire amount and advise you to keep your money and go and use it somewhere else. So they have removed the initiative from the public. So it's very difficult to get money from the public. The other one would be private sector. But issues of corruption and where we are coming from. I mean, why will someone support civil society around abstract issues that don't make sense to you? If you want something changed, you go to see a minister with a briefcase and it will be done. So you invest wisely. You don't have to... The other alternative would be government, because I know your governments give funding to civil society. I mean, it's inconceivable that will happen in Kenya in the near future, unless maybe you force their hand. So, but there are options, which most of them are also could not also be attractive. Civil society, like the Center for Governance and Development, I mean, we have the capacity to do consultancies. We can also do service provision, but that also comes with the conflict of interest challenges. And when advocacy is one of your agenda, it's also difficult. I mean, you do consultancy for government, then the next time when you want to something done, well, what do you do? So there are challenges on that. And the final point I want to make, and it ties with what Dr. Bakan said, was that I think there's room within even the external funding that we have to build institutions, and I think he put it so well, for the long term. Donor policies are around funding for civil society like now, you have a sense they are, I mean, what do you call it, designed to perpetuate, you know, dependency. I think there's room, things like rental premises, I think there could be room. Why would you pay rent for an organization for 20 years and you cannot allow them to get a mortgage? And you spend the money anyway. Why can't it be structured in a way that can, I mean, give them some independence in the medium and long term? Issues like endowment. Why don't you structure the funding so that they can build endowments? That they can, you have to begin from somewhere. So some of those policies can be changed. I mean, we are building institutions and the institution for the long term. Let's structure the funding in such a way that we foresee a situation where the partner will, you know, stand on their two legs and walk at some point and survive without us. Or if they are supposed to get something from us, that is minimal. Thank you very much.
Okay.
30 seconds.
I'll make it 3 points instead of four, since civil society has already been discussed. A little quieter diplomacy, particularly within Kenya, might be the best way to go from here on out. That is to say, certainly once it's clear where the U.S. stands by the statement of the president, the interview he gave with KBC, and Vice President Biden, but after that, we've had a very peripatetic ambassador who seems to be everywhere. And I don't know. I'll let the Kenyans respond to that. Secondly, political parties. I'm sorry, Feroz, I disagree with you. The research shows, frankly, that in terms of the development of the legislature, strong disciplined parties actually complicate it. And until there are programmatic-based political parties in Africa, which is generally not the pattern now, it's extremely difficult for the donors to get involved in this thicket. They've tried. They get burnt. I won't elaborate all the ins and out of this. It's just very difficult to do given, you know, the limited time and resources. I would focus more on state institutions, and that brings me around finally to the Electoral Commission and the election of 2012. I'll endorse what Mary said. We need to start now. We need to be clear who the viable partners are in this period of transition from the Interim Election Commission and also from the Boundary Commission, because there's this whole issue on the constituencies, how they're going to be drawn, and how the boundaries of the counties are drawn. And frankly, we have some useful technical skills here that can be brought to bear, but the dialogue has to begin now. And you know, IFAS, NDI have a lot of capacity here because, as many of you know who are in this room, most of what we do in this area, we rely on contractors for better or worse, and that requires some lead times.
Listen, I want to thank our speakers very much. I mean, what I'm getting out of this is focus on the elections. Begin focusing now. Focus on institutions rather than individuals. There are going to be new institutions created and new institutional relationships, a new relationship between the executive and the legislature. What does that say for our engagement with the legislator? This devolution brings up all kinds of issues about capacity, about oversight at a local level, which also says something about civil society's need to kind of deepen to the local level to provide mechanisms of oversight there. And really using our voice strategically at key moments of opportunity. I think it's been a remarkable past year for U.S. engagement in Kenya, especially, as I said at the outset, given everything else that's going on. I think, at least in this administration, I think that's very likely to continue, particularly with an advocate and a champion for this in the person of Michelle. So I want to thank, again, all our panelists, our audience for being with us today and the full day. It's been a terrific set of discussions. And we're hoping to write up a summary of this and then audio, if you want to go back and listen to this again and again, will be on our website. Okay. Thank you.